So good afternoon. I'll ask our panelists to take their seat. My name is Gary Koretsky. I am the Dean of the Graduate School at Weill Cornell Medical College and the Vice Dean for Research of the Medical College. And it's my privilege to be here as part of Charter Day. I'm actually also an alumnus of Cornell, so I won't tell you what year I graduated. It's a spectacular event, it's a spectacular institution, and it's almost 50 degrees, so that's great for April. What I'd like to do is just give a brief introduction to what we're going to do today. Today we're bringing faculty from three campuses, from here in Ithaca, from the Weill Cornell Medical College in New York and the Tech School, campus in New York. And what we're going to do is that we're going to tell you a little bit about wellness, fulfillment, and good health. Before that, though, I've got to read an announcement. May I have your attention, please? So please note that there are emergency exits, and that's not one of them. So there's an exit there and two exits in the back. And so in the event of an emergency or a fire alarm, proceed quickly and calmly out the nearest emergency exit available to you. And then also, just out of courtesy for our presenters, please turn off your cell phones and please refrain from taking pictures or videos. The event is being recorded, so please try not to obstruct the camera view. So with that, what I'd like to do is just give you a brief introduction to what it is that we're going to talk about today. Over the years, because of advances in medicine, there's been a great increase in longevity in this country, in countries around the world. But we've discovered, I think we always knew this, that it's not just long life, but there are many, many other things to wellness, to good health, to fulfillment. And the basic paradigm for our panel today is the notion that our health and well-being are determined by a number of different factors, by genetics, by environmental factors, and also psychosocial factors. And we have experts that will tell you a little bit about their research and their work and their interests in each of these domains. I'll just introduce this briefly. I think that everybody is aware of the revolution in genetics. It makes medical journals, it makes Time magazine, and there's been the search for these elusive genes that are responsible for long life. One notion was that after we sequenced the genome, we would be able to discover what are the genes that give us long life. And in fact, there are scientists that study model organisms, fruit flies, worms, to try to understand what makes those organisms live longer. And there have been comparative genetic analyses, and in fact, there have been studies of multiple patients that live there, or individuals that live very long lives. This was a study that was published in 2012, and the idea was to compare individuals who live very, very long lives with those who don't, and look for the gene signatures that tell you what gives you a long life. And in fact, there are a few genes, or changes in the genes that are concordant with, that correlate with long life. So that was an interesting discovery. I think Mark's going to tell us a little bit more about this in our last talk today. The relevance of this actually for everybody in this room is probably not that high. You have your genetic material already. Most of us won't have our genetic material changed. So it might be interesting to know whether you carry any of these different alleles, but it's probably not going to really answer the question about what it is that you can do to increase the fulfillment or the health of your life. So beyond genetics, what are the other major factors? Well, one certainly is environmental. I'll just show you this slide. This is taken from an individual who lives in northeastern Pennsylvania. We're here in Ithaca. We're here at a place where sustainability, environmental consciousness is very high. I've only been at Cornell, Weill Cornell now for 18 months. I used to be in Pennsylvania, where there isn't the same sense of concern, perhaps, about fracking. And this individual lives in northeastern Pennsylvania, and she's discovered that when the water comes out of the tap, it's flammable. And that's an environmental concern for her. The fracking companies say, don't worry about it. I think maybe we should worry a little bit about that. But in fact, this is a societal issue. And this is something about environment that certainly affects health. It's more on a macro scale. But also there are environmental factors that we choose. So they're lifestyle choices. And we're going to talk a little bit about things that we can do. Orly is going to tell us a little bit about choices that we can make that might enhance our ability to modify our own environments. So there's genetics, there's environments. There are also psychosocial factors that we don't live isolated, that we live in a community. And how we live within our community has a great bearing on our health, our well-being. In our third talk, we're going to hear quite a bit about individuals who have difficulty sometimes in making social connections and the impact of that, and then ways that we can think about dealing with that to improve health. So the bottom line is that our health and well-being are determined by not just our genetics, not just our environmental, but also our psychosocial factors. Our panelists aren't going to answer these questions, but they're going to address these questions. And that is, how can one live a happier, healthier life? Our colleagues who are expert, you know, we're making these major advances in science. We're also making major advances in technology. And we're going to learn a little bit about what new technologies are available so that one can manage or monitor their own health and well-being. And bottom line is how can we age comfortably in this very, very complicated world? So we'll have four panelists. I'm not going to introduce them. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves so I don't take time away from them. They'll each give their presentations, and then we intend to have some time for questions and discussions at the end. So thank you very much for joining us, and we hope you find the next hour or so very interesting.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here today and to see so many familiar faces. My name is Orly Ettingen. I'm a professor of clinical medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, and I practice clinical medicine. I spend most of my time taking care of patients, and I teach residents and medical students how to take care of patients and how to be clinicians as well. In the next 12 minutes, which is what I've been allotted, what I'd like to speak about is really how we use vitamins and supplements. I let me just get to my presentation here. There we go. It's kind of embarrassing. I'm sitting here with my tech colleagues, and I'm very tech-challenged myself. As a clinician, you know, one of the most common questions that I get asked when I see patients every single day is, should I be taking vitamins and supplements? I mean, as you know, the pharmaceutical industry has really put forth the beneficial effects of many vitamins and supplements. And we really, as clinicians, have to rely on evidence-based medicine. And so I'll present to you some of the data, the things we know about supplements, the things we don't know about supplements, and how I advise my patients and how I would suggest that it's best to use these to be healthy and to stay healthy. Vitamins, I don't know what happened there. Talk about tech challenged. It didn't look like that before. $85 billion are spent annually in this country by consumers on vitamins. And there are very few, if any, controlled studies looking at the efficacy of vitamins. Vitamins and supplements are not at all subject to FDA testing. So really, from one bottle of a particular brand of vitamin to the next bottle, you really have very little idea of the constancy of the substance you're taking, let alone its identity. And we don't, you know, generally say there's no role for any vitamins. I mean, some vitamins actually do work in certain clinical settings. Vitamin D, for instance, is very important for bone health and for brain health, and has actually been shown to augment the effects of many antidepressants and mood stabilizers. So that's probably my favorite vitamin, the safest vitamin, and something that most people can and probably should take in appropriate doses. Vitamin B12 is also a reasonable vitamin to take for people especially who are vegetarians. Vitamin B12 actually helps nerve regrowth and helps many different conditions in which there's some minor nerve degeneration. Some vitamins really don't work at all, and the studies that have looked at them almost consistently disprove their efficacy. Vitamin C, which got a tremendous amount of press for colds, for cancer, for other things, in any controlled study seems to have no efficacy at all. Same for vitamin E. And many vitamins can actually be quite dangerous when they're taken in excess. Vitamin D, for instance, if taken in excess, can precipitate kidney stones. Vitamin K can cause blood clotting. So it's not something that people should take really with abandon. Just to hone it down, probably vitamin A has been shown to be efficacious for people with macular degeneration and can improve visual acuity for some patients. Vitamin B, the vitamin in the B category for vegetarians. Vitamin C really doesn't help anybody for anything. And D for mood and bones. And E may, in some studies in combination with other medications, lessen the progression of Alzheimer's disease. I generally suggest to my patients that they really pick and choose carefully and don't take anything without discussing it with me or with another practitioner involved in their care. Herbs and supplements are another category that have been very aggressively promoted. $10 billion is spent annually on herbs and supplements. These aren't tested at all for purity. And in the latest studies that came out within the last year, a third of the herbs and supplements are outright substitutions, and half are contaminated with other substances. So when you go into four different vitamin stores and get an herb, for instance, it will be vastly different what you're taking from store to store. And many of the herbs and botanicals are really imported from abroad, where there are even fewer manufacturing standards than in the United States. So when it comes to those, it's a little bit like the pharmacist is telling the patient here, it's a mood elevator. Each capsule contains 10 milligrams of Zippity and 5 of Duda. And it's really that kind of situation. In fact, the Attorney General now is really cutting down, as you may have read, on many of the store brand herbs that are being marketed. Supplements versus prescription drugs are much less safe. Vitamins, minerals, botanicals, amino acids, none of these are really subject to any kind of FDA testing. So it's only the manufacturer that's responsible for assuring safety and efficacy. And there are independent websites like consumerlab.com that have actually looked at the various vitamins and supplements to try to determine which are the least contaminated, is there the most consistency and the most actual identity of the substance to what they're claiming that it is. So can any of the herbs and supplements help you age better, feel better? Well, it turns out that fish oil was really one of the big stories a number of years ago, and 85 million people in the United States take fish oil. I mean, how many of you take fish oil, for instance? Yeah, I mean, that's a representative, maybe a third to a half of the population taking fish oil. You know, the interesting story about fish oil is it came to be because of the observation that Eskimos have less heart disease than other populations. And so from that came the hypothesis that it must be because they eat more fish, and then came the fish oil, and that's how it was marketed. But when all the studies have been done, and there are many meta-analyses now looking at fish oil is not really efficacious for stroke or for heart disease, and fish oil does thin the blood and can have some deleterious effects too. So when it comes to fish oil, I usually tell my patients, just eat the fish. Because that's what the Eskimos are doing. If we're trying to be the Eskimos, then let's eat the fish. I mean, if you're allergic to fish, that's another story. But unless you are, you're better off eating the fish. I'll mention a couple of other popular herbs. There's St. John's wort, which is actually Hypericum, which is Prozac. It's the same chemical as Prozac. So it may help depression. In the ones that have some Prozac in them, it probably will help depression as much as Prozac would. But again, you have no idea from bottle to bottle what you're actually taking. And it's amazing to me as a clinician that patients would much rather take St. John's wort because it's biological or natural, or they don't have to say they're on an antidepressant. But when you actually think about what you're doing, you're taking something whose identity is really completely unknown. SAMe is an amino acid, and there are actually some controlled studies on S-adenosylmethionine that show that it is actually beneficial for some patients with depression and arthritis. Melatonin may help in sleep, and ginkgo, all the meta-analyses, no benefit to memory. But, you know, when it comes to memory as a symptom, there's a huge placebo effect. So a lot of people swear that the ginkgo helps. So can these herbs harm you too? Well, you know, they've not really been tested. I mean, natural doesn't mean safe, because cocaine is natural. Tobacco's natural. You know, many of these herbs actually interfere with the binding of prescription medicines to their molecules, to their receptors, and so on. So the herbs can really interfere with things that you should be taking, that you are taking. And so I wouldn't assume that because they're natural, they're definitely safe. One of the interesting studies that came out in the last year shows that if you take vitamin C and vitamin E together, and these are very commonly taken, that you may actually negate the beneficial effects of exercise on your metabolism. So, I mean, if that's not going to stop you from taking vitamins, nothing will. I just put this slide up to say that, you know, some vitamins, maybe 1 or 2%, will actually provide a certificate of analysis if you ask for it from the drug company. Some of them will provide an FDA manufacturer's GMP sort of seal of approval. They're much more expensive, and they're very few and far between. But in the last few years, DNA barcoding as a technique has been used to identify what's in vitamins and supplements, which is how we get this information. So let me just, there are over 50,000 adverse reactions yearly. The two main kinds are that a supplement will enhance a medication effect or negate an effect, especially among the blood thinners. And so there are a lot of negative effects. And as we see in this cartoon, the woman is saying to, you know, her neighbor, apparently I need to lower the dose of salmon capsules that I'm giving Don and the kids. We really just don't know what the side effects are going to be. among the probiotics are another class of sort of du jour, popular, you know, popular supplements. They've not been extensively tested yet. They are bacterial cultures in live form. The commonest ones are Acidophilus and Lactobacillus. They do actually seem to have some benefit for digestion, and especially for some of the gastrointestinal complications of the use of antibiotics. So we're starting to test this class of botanicals, herbals, and I suspect that these will turn out to be somewhat beneficial. So to sum up, the best vitamin of all, I advise my patients, is the food. Get your vitamins from food. Eat foods of every different type and color. And I'll close with one slide, which is don't forget. This will help you feel less moody, stressed, and irritable. It's a prescription for chocolate. Don't forget that either. Thank you very much.
Okay. So delighted to be up here. I'm a relatively new Cornellian. I joined the Cornell Tech Campus in New York City in January of 2013. And have spent much more time down in our Manhattan campus, which is at the moment rent-free space in the Google building in Chelsea. And we're watching as our construction is beginning on Roosevelt Island. And we'll be there late summer 2017. Because we have to be there, because Google won't have us anymore. So we might be in a tent, a partially constructed building, but that's where we'll be. And we're up and running and delighted to answer questions about it, but that's not the topic of the panel. So I want to tell you a little bit about work I've been doing for a while with a large group of collaborators and many clinical collaborators. I'm not a real doctor. I'm a PhD computer scientist by training. And before coming to Cornell, I was at UCLA for many years on faculty, before that at USC, and I did my doctorate work in computer science at MIT. So I'm interested in how we can personalize our healthcare. Given our genes, I can't do anything about that. Many people can't do very much to change the environment where they live. But we can, for the most part, as was alluded to, change health behaviors we choose to adopt. And we can also begin to use tools to help pay more attention to how different medications or treatment regimens are working for us, and to give better information to our clinicians as they try to care for us. So as a technical person, I think of these things as the feedback loops of health, and we can bring much more data to them than we ever could before. Whether it's me trying to understand whether those probiotics are working for me, or that ginkgo biloba, or whether it's to give my clinician feedback on their change adjustments in the medication dosage that they're giving me. So we do this, and where we're exploring doing this, is with the data that we all generate every day implicitly. So when you purchase items, as you walk around with your mobile phone in your pocket or pouch, as you manage finances, as you enter things in your calendar, as you write emails to people or update messages on social media, and as you move around in space, all these things are generating digital traces, not just through our smartphones, but also through our online behavior. And I refer to this as small data because it's all about me. So typically, there's a lot of incredible work going on in the big data space, where whether it's a hospital or a pharmaceutical company, they're looking at what's happened across a large population of users, or Amazon or Google, right? All of those systems are learning really rapidly now because they have so much data across all their users. And that's good and really important stuff. But what I'm talking about is that just for me as an individual, or for you, if I can get access to all these different data streams, they can tell a lot about me over time. How I'm responding to a medication, how I'm responding to physical therapy, whether I'm recovering as expected from a surgery. And that's this area that we explore. So we take raw data, much of which comes from the phone or online behavior, and sometimes a real sensor. And we automatically process that data in a way that it can become a kind of a behavioral biomarker. So people use biomarkers that they pull out of blood samples or saliva samples. And to add to that is the opportunity now to have markers that come from our behavior, because now our behavior becomes data and is available for analysis. I have some great examples to share with you that come. I particularly wanted to emphasize Cornell products here. So Paragon Measures is the startup company of Yaron Levinson. Yaron Levinson joined the Jacobs Institute, which is a part of Cornell Tech, joint venture with the Technion. He joined a very innovative postdoc program there. This is a postdoc program for people who during their PhD work have developed some technology, and they want to do a postdoc not to do publications and head for academia, but rather to start a company. But their technology isn't ready for incubation yet. So Jacobs came up with the Institute came up with a very innovative way of funding these postdocs who also become part of our innovation ecosystem that we're growing at Cornell Tech and in New York City. So Yaron's innovation is that he takes your everyday tapping on your phone and is able to pull out of that detailed analytics about your fine motor control. And he's using that to apply it to things like understanding progression of Parkinson's, but also things like understanding of rheumatoid arthritis, which when you're in a flare, you're moving your joints with far more difficulty. Another example of a Cornell product came several years earlier from Jerry Gay, professor here in Information Sciences and Communication, and her PhD student at the time, J.P. Pollock, where they used the smartphone not so much to automatically collect data in the way that your own is, but used the capability of the phone to deliver us images to come up with a different way of measuring mood. How do we know that Sam E. or St. John's Wort reduces depression? Do we have a biomarker for depression? Do we put everyone under an fMRI? No. It's a clinician who decided that this person is less depressed and that the person was reporting that they're less depressed. Here's a way, instead of answering a number of textual survey questions, when you open up the app, you see 16 images, and you tap the one that represents your mood. They're not always the same images, but they're along the two dimensions of affect, high and low energy and positive and negative. And this has been tested in side-by-side validated studies to be as effective and far quicker and less onerous for users to actually make use of. So the smartphone is contributing in ways both as a source of data and as a source of interaction. We're using this to now do a version of this around pain. Pain, like depression, is very difficult to measure. It relies inherently on self-report. But one of the ways in which people look at pain is not just to ask you on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your pain like? And if your pain has actually improved 10% since your last visit, we don't notice 10% improvement in pain. And yet that might be really important to know about, because the course of action that and the treatment that your doctor is giving you should be continued because it is improving, as opposed to abandoned because we can't tell the difference. So we have an interaction with pictures to identify on a hard day, whether you have lower back pain or rheumatoid arthritis, what is difficult for you. And then, again on your smartphone, we have specialized buttons just for you to report on those activities that were difficult, so you can easily create a heat map of those days that are your hardest. With all these different ways of capturing data on the smartphone and online, where we are now is in the state of needing to figure out how to make sense out of them. So we can do passive day-to-day quantification of how you're doing, and we can begin to share this within the caregiving network that often isn't just the clinician, but might be a family member, a visiting nurse, and so on. So we're in the state of activating the small data to figure out of all those noisy bits, what's the relevant data, and also to figure out who should see this data to help us actually take action on it. So most people don't have time to sit there and look at lots of data. neither clinicians nor patients. So we're working on applications that are going to be fueled by these data, but in the end, look like applications that people download to their phones. I just want to tell you about a few of them as I close. In the context of chronic pain, as I was describing, we take people's visual kinds of self-report combined with passively collected location and mobility. So as people are going undergoing treatment, you can see that somebody, maybe it's post-hip surgery, knee surgery, a treatment for lower back pain, you can see that the total number of minutes walking day by day is overall improving. You can see the number of hours they spend out of the house is overall increasing. As a type of automated measure to get indication on whether a particular course of treatment is helping the individual. And we're working particularly in this space with colleagues at Hospital for Special Surgery who would like to eventually have all of their hip and knee replacement patients be using this for a while leading up to surgery, by which they can try to encourage them to be as active as is appropriate, and then be able to see post-surgery how is somebody recovering. Are they overdoing it and at risk of having something negative happen? Or have they plateaued and somebody should actually intervene? We're also looking at a similar question. This is far more researchy, as to how some of these small data can give you indications around cognitive function. And one of the richest sources of data we're looking at there is email. So our language is somewhat reflective of our cognitive state. And we can run natural language processing over your historical email and look for things around grammatical complexity, use of proper nouns. That's what we're exploring. What are those telling features? So that people can begin to build a better way of understanding whether it's cognitive fatigue during chemo, cognitive impairment side effects of a medication, or the beginnings of cognitive decline. One of the biggest problems in advancing the field of treating Alzheimer's and dementia is that for the most part, by the time you get to the subjects in a clinical study, they're already pretty advanced. And we need to find ways of being able to identify individuals much earlier if we're going to be able to drive clinical studies that will lead to effective treatment. A last example I want to give you isn't what we usually think of as about medicine, but it's clearly about health and wellness. If you go upstream of a lot of our conditions, as we were just hearing, it's about what you eat. And yet if there's a habit that is hard to change, right, it's actually doing the right things to our body day by day and for our family day by day. So we've built a system that we call PushCart. And the system is intended to help individuals improve the food environment that they have at home. So when you're tired and at the end of the day, what you have at home to prepare dinner as opposed to picking up or ordering in takeout, the snacks you have available at home when you're sitting and watching or binging on Netflix, another digital data stream that can be used in this whole context. We make use of online grocery shopping, and once you sign up for the system, we receive your grocery receipts. And we parse them, we analyze them, and we use nutritional information that's out there on the web. All of this is a program doing this, to create a summary of the healthiness of your grocery cart, week to week. And then at this point, it's not automated, a nutritionist is looking at your progress week to week, suggesting healthy substitutes, oranges for orange juice, those sorts of things, that are in line with what you're after. And they can notice as you take those substitutes or as you ignore them, and they might suggest something else. And they can also notice 6 months later when you've either had family around, the holidays, some personal crisis, travel, and like most of us, good habits established start to slide back and without you having to do any food journaling. So we use the small data of your week-to-week grocery shopping to give a vehicle by which nutritionists and dietitians can help coach you to a healthier situation. So I just wanted to end by mentioning that at Cornell Tech, we're starting a new health tech program in the fall. We're very excited about it, and we're really becoming a centerpiece of the health tech ecosystem in New York City. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanzeem Chaudhry, and I'm also not a real doctor. And I have a PhD, and probably also it's not clear because I did my PhD at the MIT Media Lab, where officially my PhD is in.
Is that supposed to be?
Yeah. In architecture, but closest probably is in computer science with a highly interdisciplinary bent. And now I'm a faculty member here in the Ithaca campus in information sciences. So I want to actually start with a question for all of you. How many of you have seen a close friend or a family member or yourself kind of suffer through horrible disease like cancer? So a huge number of you. How about heart disease? Again, we see a lot. So how many of you have actually seen a family member or close friend suffer through some mental health disorder? So if you look at the numbers, we saw the highest number of hands, at least from my kind of observation, is for cancer. So if we look at some of the numbers, and now hopefully my thing will show up, is about 1 in 23 suffer from cancer. The number is about 1 in 10 for heart disease, and 1 in 6 suffer from mental illness. So much higher than heart disease or cancer. And one of the challenges has been that there isn't really a yes or no diagnosis or easy way to say that someone is suffering from mental health disorders. And as Deborah was mentioning, often it's about self-report, and you go and your clinician assesses whether they think that you have depression or sometimes even more serious mental illness like bipolar disorder. And that's why many of us can suffer from mental illness without ever realizing, acknowledging, or more importantly, being treated for it. But there are a lot of behavioral signs of mental illness which could be leveraged and where technology can help. So what are some of the signs of mental illness? Let me give you some quotes that we got directly from patients. My wife can tell by my walk. I didn't want to wake up. I was having a much better time asleep. My legs bounce. Speech goes fast. I even eat too fast. I barely have any social contact. These are actually actual patient codes that show that physical activity, how a person sleeps, how they speak, and their social activity are all important indicators of a person's mental well-being. Unfortunately, we're able to get at all these measures using a device that all of you carry on your in your pockets. It's the smartphone. And more importantly, I'm sure many of you here are wearing a Fitbit, Jawbone, some kind of wearable device, which is becoming much more popular. And there's like where there's wearable device, there are things that you can swallow, there are things that you can put all over your body. And which is a great time, because this is what wearables looked like when I was a grad student. So nobody would want to be seen like this. So as I mentioned, that there are these important indicators. So let me start with sleep. This is an example of sleep where I show you the one night's sleep for two types of patients, a normal subjects and someone who is depressed. So if you look at their kind of REM periods, it's an EEG signal, and the minutes of sleep, we see lower activity as well as shorter duration of sleep. In our work, what we looked at is just, and many others have done that as well, is just looking at smartphone usage, we are able to infer duration of sleep, whether your sleep gets interrupted, and also even something, just when you wake up, based on the type of applications that you use, are you straight going into looking at doing your email, or are you actually killing time on Facebook? What your body clock is, are you actually in line with your chronotype or internal body clock, or are you out of sync? We have done in the kind of direction of wearables in our not kind of non-phone systems. We've done also mobile systems that look at just like the using Doppler radar, just like the device that the police uses to see if you're speeding or not, to actually get at information like breathing rate, heart rate, and movement. And by combining all this, we can actually estimate that how long it takes you to fall asleep, how many times do you get up in your sleep, and to get a measure that often sleep researchers use called sleep efficiency. So just by using simple mobile devices, we are able to get very precise measurements of sleep. Now, let me give you another example, which is, as we said, voice, and which a lot of my research had looked at, is just how we speak matters. And one of the advantages of having a real computer that you carry 24/7 is that it's not about violating your privacy by collecting audio data 24/7. What we can do is process the audio real time on your phone and just extract information that can tell us when and how someone speaks and actually explicitly throw away information about what a person says. So we actually are using that to collect data from individuals that have currently running experiment with patients with bipolar disorder as well as schizophrenia. And one of the reasons that we are able to collect these type of information from a sensitive population is we are actually having a balance, what we call privacy-sensitive processing of speech that balances the richness of information we get without really being invasive of one's privacy. Although I will say that there is still privacy implication. We know when someone's speaking, we can tell the gender, we can tell if someone's yelling or not, but we can also get information about how much they're speaking. So if we see someone who has an active conversational network, so this is showing one, the main person, who they're talking to, whether they're talking in large groups, small groups, long duration, short duration. If after 2 weeks their network looks like this, we know something has happened, right? And if it persists like that, that is a cause for concern. And we've actually done some experiment, and this is actually where we looked at correlated these voice patterns with standard surveys that physicians use in terms of depression scale, mental health scale, and showed that there is high correlation. This was done actually in an elderly population. So it's really kind of valuable data that we can get, and we have also been able to show connection to a person's mental wellness. And although these types of technology is hugely beneficial in collecting rich data, one of the things that we have to also have the opportunity to do is to move from data to intervention. And this intervention can come in many, many different ways. And we're exploring with several different kind of directions. One is if I know designing context-triggered interventions. So when a patient who has depression might have disturbed sleep and the therapist might tell him or her to have certain strategies to improve their sleep. In this case, when we know a patient is having disturbed sleep, some of these interventions can be delivered just in time rather than having to wait 2 weeks until the next time the patient sees their therapist. We could also give much more specific data about how to change behavior. So this is work on when we did in the context of physical activity, where just mining where you walk, how you walk, which location you're more active, it's giving specific suggestion of this route to take. Oh, maybe you should go and have lunch here. So it's giving you much more specific guidance of how you can change your behavior. And this is actually just a background screen where it's a privacy-sensitive one because you don't know what these fishes mean, but it actually gives physical activity, sleep, and social activity data awareness to the user in the background screen. So the clownfish is the user. If they are very active, it will move around. The social activity is the friends or the other fishes that are nearby, and the light level tells you whether you have slept enough or not. And I want to kind of give another example of some very, very recent work that we've been doing. And Deborah alluded to that we don't have time to really look at our data in detail. And one of the ideas that we are exploring is, do we even want the user to look at these types of information and act on it, or whether we can make it happen just automatically? And this is definitely still a controversial and unvalidated area, but I'll give you some example. So can we actually influence behavior subconsciously? The reason why we think that we can, so if you look at, in psychology, there's this notion of dual process theory, or in behavioral economics, it's often referred to as system one, system two, where it says there's certain reaction that happens automatically, right? We instinctively react to certain things. And there's other actions that we take by actually reflecting and thinking carefully and acting on that data. And so can we actually make behavior change a system one process? So we have done some very preliminary experiments that seems very encouraging. So one example is, I talked about voice and modulating voice. So one idea that we had was, if you, there is psychology literature that says if you smile more, you actually feel happier. So we wanted to see if we can modulate a person's voice, does it have an effect? So one thing that we did is just looking at taking a person's voice in real time, modulating it, so we actually shifted pitch, and fed it back to the user in very, very low amplitude. And what we saw is we're able to actually lower or higher a person's pitch from their baseline. So, and it's not just useful in health. People in business school really are interested in these kind of research because confidence and presence are associated with lower pitch. So we actually show that we can shift it about 14% from their baseline just by modulating and pitch shifting. And this has actually been validated also in the context of where people have used this technology effectively, in some cases, to reduce stuttering. So we think that there is some substance there, but we still need to do a lot more work to really prove it effective in behavior change. So I want to end by saying that mental illness, treating mental illness is complex, right? So there is a social support component, there is the medication is important, but I think in the realm of behavior tracking and behavioral intervention, technology and particularly mobile technology can play a very, very important role. And it's important for us to realize that mental aspect health affects every aspect of our health. We know that other chronic conditions like heart disease, even cancer or diabetes, there is the outcomes are worse if someone has comorbid depressive disorder. Often hospital readmission rates are higher. There is also, this is the number one cause for disability worldwide. So we hope that some of the technology that we're building will help towards being able to treat mental illness in a broad population where people both are suffering from serious mental illness, but also have comorbid mental health disorder and help them lead to achieve overall well-being. Thank you.
Can you pull mine up?
This is yours, yep. Sir. Okay, you want to present it?
Maximize.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Lax. I'm a physician scientist at the medical college where I also run geriatric medicine. How old is geriatrics? I will quote my favorite patient who for the last 20 years has said 10 years older than I am at any one particular time. It's a pleasure to be here because today I don't have to be this guy, which is what I do most days. Here's what I'm not going to talk about today. Diet, exercise, cholesterol, colonoscopy, weight loss, abstinence from, and I wrote, insert your favorite vice here. No, I'm going to talk about some other things that contribute to exceptional longevity. First, I'd like to dispense with the question I most frequently ask, which is, how old is your oldest patient? And here she is. Helen Happy Reichert, Cornell class of 1925, died just shy of her 110th birthday a few years back. Here she is. Apple picking. Here she met former Governor Patterson. I said, Helen, pretty sweet, met the governor. What'd you think? And she said, well, I wanted to tell him he was the worst governor in my lifetime. Because when you're 107, you can do stuff like that, okay? So here's a multiple choice question for you. What was her secret? A, copious red wine consumption. B, 500 calories a day, in which case you die of depression, I think. C, genetics. D, financial resources. E, two of the above. Anybody want to take a guess? Holler it out. I heard everything. I heard mostly E's. The answer turns out it's E. So Helen was loaded. And in about 300 studies dating back to the 1950s, it turns out that wealth is one of the most compelling risk factors of longevity and quality longevity. There have been a number of studies on NPR and the Times in the last few weeks about income inequality that look at this. It's probably not wealth itself. It's probably the things that got you wealthy in the first place, like locus of control and mastery and a whole bunch of things that my psychology colleagues like to talk about. But Helen also had a longevity gene. And let me talk a little bit about this. It turns out that when we geriatricians study people with exceptional longevity, generally folks who survive to over 95, you find that they have one or more longevity genes. Gary talked about this in his introduction. And just to prove to you that she did, let me introduce you to Helen's brother, Irving, who died a few weeks back, also at 109 years old. I took care of him at the end of his life. He was going to the office three or four times a week until 2 months before he passed, picking stocks. And he was really, really good at it. And here's what's interesting when you study people with longevity genes. For these folks, the usual rules don't apply. Less than 10% of them are vegetarian. They're not especially active. Helen told me she'd never been to a gym in her life, never taken a supplement. She liked to have a Budweiser every night. They have a variety of not so great health habits. Here she is at 101. She told me she was taking up smoking. I said, Helen, that's probably not a good idea. She said, Mark, I've outlived several primary care doctors. I plan to outlive you. And she missed many, many appointments because of social engagement. So her access to medical care was not so great. So, you know, what about the rest of us mere mortals? It turns out that this is a little bit of a good news, bad news story. It turns out that only a tiny percentage of folks have longevity genes, probably statistically three or four people in the audience. The good news is that its effects have been essentially overestimated. When I was a medical student in the 1980s, we were taught that longevity was completely about genes. It turns out that nature is about 20%, and nurture or environment turns out to be about 80%. That's a finding from the last decade or so. And we have data about some of the environmental factors that promote longevity, but they're generally lost on the public. And by environment, I don't mean fracking, I don't mean mold, I don't mean radon. I'm talking about the way you live your life, how you get your care. So let me share some of these secrets with you over the next few minutes, because they might surprise you. And the first has to do with how we get our care. You can actually get too much care as you age. This is my favorite Woody Allen movie, Zelig, where the psychiatrists are trying to figure out what's wrong with him. And in America, there is an epidemic of overcare. And you might reasonably ask, how do you get too much care? Well, one is cookbook medicine, in which everybody gets Lipitor for cholesterol of X, or a mammography or colonoscopy. The over-screening of America. Every day I hear I can get a full CT scan to screen for a variety of diseases. Marketing tests directly to consumers. Too many specialists. I practice in New York City. There's a guy who does your right thumb, a guy who does your left thumb. There's a person attached to all those body parts, you know, and it's probably good to have someone who knows what one hand is doing. A supersize me culture. Get a bigger meal at McDonald's. Get a bigger room at the Statler. It's got to be better if there's more. And then there's direct-to-consumer drug advertising, which I despise. Each morning, I have to talk a patient, takes about a half hour, out of a drug they saw advertised on television last night, when I could, in fact, be examining them or speaking with them. The comedian Chris Rock has a great line. He says, they don't even tell you what the drug does. They show a man on a horse, a lady in a tub, and they just keep naming symptoms until they say one you got, and you say, I'm sick, I need that drug. So what can you do to protect yourself? Well, understand the rationale for every test you get. Subspecialty care is wonderful, but there's a person attached to all those body parts. You need a primary care doctor. There's some things under the Affordable Care Act that will make that more possible, perhaps. Take responsibility for your medical records, especially your medication list if you're traveling. I get a call from Europe or San Francisco. Someone's in an emergency department, one of my patients. They don't know what their meds are. It's critical. The most important primary care provider, look in the mirror. If you're docile in your care and you think that the institution or the medical system will care for you, you're making really a grave mistake. You have to be proactive in your care. It's a lot of the presentations we heard earlier about feedback loops. But there's another side to this, which is ageism in healthcare. You can get too little care as you age. This is my favorite New Yorker cartoon where a little guy with his doctor kid says to his dad, because of your age, I'm going to recommend doing nothing. You can get too little care as you get older. Study after study shows that physicians have the same bias among older people that society has. I'll give you a couple of examples from my own practice. A few months ago, I saw a woman with breast cancer swimming a mile a day, would have benefited from modern chemotherapy, but was not offered that simply because of her chronologic age. She was probably physiologically 2 decades younger. You want to get a geriatrician angry at you? Tell him or her that you won't do an angioplasty, you know, that piece of rigatoni they put in your arteries, okay? Tell a geriatrician you don't want to do that on his patient simply because they're old. I have no interest in rationing care on the basis of age. I don't want to do that to someone who's bedbound or chair fast, but that person who's working, dating, socializing, has an enormous amount to lose when care is withheld. So when someone says to you, I don't want to do this simply because you're old, you need to think twice about that and be very quizzical about it. I'm going to change gears here and show you some compelling data about the quality and size of social networks and longevity. We know that shrinking social networks predict bad things, but it turns out in the last decade we've learned that the opposite is true, and this is not just tree-hugging. This is actually quantitative science in which we measure the size and quality of social networks with specific instruments, iPhones, who do you see every day, who do you speak to every day. I could give you hundreds of examples. This is a study of breast cancer and social connectedness. This is survival. Everybody's alive at time zero, going 7 years out. The people in red had high social connectedness. The people in black had low social connectedness, okay? This is adjusted for the degree of breast cancer, lymph nodes, extent of disease, age, and there's a very significant survival difference. It's been shown in dozens and dozens of studies. So I would say build substantial social networks and relationships. Be the annoying guy or gal. There's someone in every college class, maybe he or she is here now, who sends the email, who invites folks. That is something you need to work at. It's extraordinarily important. But perceptions, and if ever there was an example about how the brain in psychology influenced longevity, this is it, can also affect aging. I have a colleague, Becca Levy at Yale, who has been doing attitudinal studies for 30 years now of middle-aged folks. She gives questions to people like, as you become older, you become less useful. It's normal to become disabled as you age. Things keep getting worse as I get older, and she's followed now people who answer half glass full and half glass empty for a number of years, and look at this data. This goes out 23 years, 100% of people surviving. The upper graph here is high perceptions about aging. The lower graph, low perceptions about aging. 7-year difference in longevity. After adjusting for chronic illnesses, medications, genetics, heredity, remarkable stuff. So I would say that if you think your attitudes about aging have no impact on how long you'll live, you might just want to adjust your attitude before it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Look, I'm a geriatrician. We tend to be optimistic like the pediatricians. I know that getting older has challenges. We lose friends and family sometimes. Children may move away. But there's some compelling data about aging that make it fabulous. Marriages that survive have the highest degree of satisfaction in any age range among older adults. Most retirement studies suggest that it's a blast in doses if you remain involved in meaningful activities around volunteerism or church or synagogue or not-for-profit work. Aging offers freedoms unfettered by earlier barriers. I had a patient who told me a number of years ago that he was fired on the spot because he told his young tech boss that he was an idiot. Fired him on the spot. I said, that must have been terrible. He said, no, it was terrific. Because when I was 30 and I had 3 mouths to feed, I dreamed of telling the boss that he was an idiot. So aging offers freedom. The data on happiness is very compelling. You know, there's a bimodal peak. My colleague Dr. Pillemer here in human ecology studied this. There's a big peak of happiness in your early 20s. You then have families and it drops very significantly. And then it rises again in late life, even in the face of chronic illness. So I have many favorite quotes about aging, but I will leave you with my favorite from the humorist Will Rogers. He said, "One must wait until evening to realize how splendid the day has been." Thank you very much.
Well, maybe just another round of applause for all of the panelists. I think this was terrific. I learned to become an optimist, thank you, Mark, and also to try to have a lower pitch voice, so thank you, Mark. We do have time for questions. We wanted to make sure we did leave time for questions. If you have a question, shout it out. I will repeat it because this is being videotaped. But maybe I'll just take the prerogative of the chair. One of the issues, certainly for physicians, is the issue of privacy. So for both Deborah and Hanzeem, your cell phone tells everybody where you shop, what you buy, whether you buy orange juice or oranges. Where are the boundaries, and what are we going to do about privacy? You commented a bit, but maybe you could expand upon that.
Certainly. How can we make things happen, and how will they happen, aren't always the same. So it's not about telling everybody anything. It's about, you don't tell everybody your blood pressure when you go to the doctor and have it checked, or even when you're sitting at CVS before picking up your prescription and using that blood pressure cuff. So contrary to what people try to teach us online, which is that don't worry about privacy, that's an old-fashioned way of thinking, we can create a world in which there is still privacy because the data you capture is shared selectively. But we have to create the architectures and create the market appetite for doing things that way.
So I agree on that, as well as that we often kind of think about privacy as an on and off thing, and one of the things that we have seen with patients who have some kind of mental health disorder, there's a trade-off between the challenges of living with severe mental illness, where it's a chronic lifelong illness, and the benefit you provide. So I think we also have to think about that carefully in terms of how do you give the user a way to choose that balance for them, right? And the example of voice that I gave was one way that we were trying to achieve that balance. So I think the balance is important, as well as what Deborah mentioned in terms of creating the infrastructure.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah, go right ahead and shout out.
For Worley, at what age or what condition do you pass your patients off to Mark?
Okay, so I'll just repeat the question. At what age do you pass off your patients
or condition
to our gerontology colleagues?
I don't think that there's a specific age that defines the difference between being cared for by an internist primary caregiver versus a geriatrician. I tend to think of the patients who have who are already struggling with some sort of degenerative disease or some sort of chronic condition that's having multiple system downstream effects as those that benefit the most. I think there's more overlap than there is separation between us in terms of our practices. I take care of some very elderly patients, and he probably takes care of patients that are much younger than many of the patients in my practice. So it's more about the clinical conditions and how many systems are involved in the degenerative process, if that is happening as the patient ages.
Yes. So I will repeat that. So the comment was to thank Orly for the publications from Weill Cornell. There are several publications that come out, and everybody should read them. Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you. And feel free to email me any questions at my Cornell email that you would like to be answered in the newsletter, because I'm always looking for questions. So do feel free.
Yes. So the question referred to one of Orly's points about the potential interaction of different vitamins and different supplements and with other events, including exercise, and how they might negate some positive effects. So are multivitamins out?
Multivitamins are pretty much out. I mean, to address your specific question about the CE interaction, it's really higher doses in combination. So doses of C that are 1,000 to 2,000 a day or greater, and doses of E that are over 400 to 800 negate each other. And the study that was done that reflected that actually looked at insulin levels and hemoglobin A1C, which is a molecule that reflects blood glucose control over 3 weeks. And the concurrent administration of high dose C and E caused higher insulin levels, which is known to be a negative risk factor for heart disease and many other metabolic conditions, including diabetes. But to come back to your multivite question, save your money. I mean, forget them. Unless you really are not, unless you've got some serious food allergy or vitamin allergy or a whole class of nutritional components that you don't eat, I think you don't really need to take them.
But Mark would like to comment as well.
Yeah, I would agree with Orly. I like to say that Americans have the most expensive urine in the world because they simply excrete most of what's given to them. I don't think it's producing harm unless there's a particular condition in your case that needs to be adjudicated. I would say that a knowledge by your primary care physician, if you have particular issues with osteoporosis or vitamin B12 deficiency, if you were a vegetarian, would be a much more judicious way of making a decision. Probably not hurting, but probably not helping is what I would say.
So maybe I'll just ask Kansim. So one of the so you talked about the prevalence of mental illness and the value perhaps of monitoring. Is there a concern though that some of these individuals are the ones who are going to be least willing to be monitored because of their diseases?
Yeah, so we had that question come up, especially when we started our kind of year-long study with patients with schizophrenia where they have paranoia and hallucination. And actually, we did do surveys and pilots of them. There are some that are concerned, but probably I would say less than 10%, because what it boiled down to, that their quality of life is so poor that they often, in when they do seek treatment, anything that would help their quality of life or improve their condition over a long time is seen as a positive thing. Although we haven't deployed it for multi-years, so it's still unclear whether they'll sustain or whether in their periods of relapse they will stop using the technology, but that's a problem all over, even including medication. But we've actually seen less resistance than we going in thought there would be. And there's been actually some work. There is a great schizophrenia researcher who's looked at mobile use technology, and they've seen that there overall generally has been more positive attitude than negative.
Other questions? Yes. So I'll just repeat that optimism and social interaction is very important. How do we then, within our society, how do we foster that? Was that the question? Yeah.
Much of the work that's going on at all the campuses, creating physical spaces where people can interact intergenerationally, melding exercise with socialization. So it's good to walk, but if you can walk with other people, that's fabulous. The environmental studies folks here have been fabulous about creating walking pathways. And one of the big questions is whether or not some of the technology can take the place, particularly in socially isolated older people, of real social interaction? I'm not sure. I don't think we know yet. Until we have sort of holographic dinners with family members who are around the country. But there is some enormous opportunities through Skype, through social engagement. You know, the biggest reason I see my much older patients, for example, get email is to interact with grandchildren. So anything that effectively encourages socialization, which is a non-toxic therapy at the end of the day, it's not chemotherapy, is to be tried, and I think you're going to see randomized trials of these interventions in the same way that you see, you know, you see interventions that effectively are used for drugs. One of my colleagues at the medical college was once asked, you know, what is the biggest contribution that the institution makes to health in its community? Is it the MRI machine? Is it the access to care? And he says, we employ people, and they interact. And that's how we help a community. So it's very, very interesting. We've learned recently that social forces are equally or more compelling than medical forces in longevity and health. So that's my answer.
Deborah?
I just wanted to add to that that we're seeing increasingly, because of the changes in the economic incentives in the healthcare system, that some things are becoming more rational. And so you have caregivers from health coaches to promotoras to visiting nurses that will become increasingly a part of the system. And technology can be helpful there in ways of helping to build trust and visibility and make that an even more integral part, not of having virtual socialization for the older person, but rather making it viable for a larger number of people to become part of their social circle, not just their established, trusted family, but to really complement that.
A question over here, yes.
Well, as I reach my mid-70s, my family, the children, keep wondering whether I'm still okay. I still work, and I do a lot of volunteer work, so I'm always on the go. So my question has to do with, what is the effect of just getting older on some of these behaviors, like sleeping through the night, or maybe forgetting what you told one daughter that you didn't tell the other daughter, and they want to make an illness out of it, and sometimes I say, I've got a lot on my mind, I'm going here and there, and I am aging.
So I guess the question, if I can paraphrase, is what's the normal process of aging that isn't perhaps the marker of a disease that requires intervention or a condition that requires intervention? So I think that can go to any of you. Start with Mark.
So there are physiologic changes that occur with normal aging. There's, for example, physiologic memory loss that's measured at each decade of life. There are physiologic changes in gait speed, for example. And it would be disingenuous of me to say that, you know, like those insurance commercials that you should be surfing at 80 and doing all the things that the media would have you do, because we live in an ageist society. We begin to get concerned about things like memory loss and other physiologic changes when they start to interfere with what we call basic activities of daily living or instrumental activities of daily living. So I'm not terribly worried about memory loss of the type that I'm experiencing, for example, at 55, unless it begins to have you getting lost, writing the wrong checks to the wrong people. It's something to keep an eye on. Hopefully you have a primary care physician who can keep an eye on that. And probably the most important prognostic thing in the discourse you just provided is having loving, concerned children as part of your social network. That's a good thing.
And I think that perhaps many of the devices that you talk about really can be designed in exactly this way, right? So having the right threshold, you know, for being a warning sign, right? So,
well, as a primary care physician, one of the things that we welcome information-wise is any objectivization of the data. And I think that the presentations we heard from our tech colleagues really speak to the ability to objectivize some of the memory data and other data in ways that really will help us take care of patients. Right now, when it comes to memory, you can do neurocognitive testing, but it's a very laborious test. So if we had simpler ways to objectivize the data, it would be a much easier way to take care of patients and answer your question.
Great. Yes.
Thank you.
So that's a great question. So the question refers to the fact that the risk of falls and actually falling is something which we worry greatly about, you know, in all patients, but especially individuals who age. And how does one parse being aware of that risk and being able to maintain your activities of life so that you can do all of the things that were suggested by our panelists? Is that correct?
So as a geriatrician, I probably should handle the fall question. About 25% of people over the age of 65 fall at least once annually. It goes up to about a third after 75. It's something we see very, very frequently. The key to preventing falling, besides having a review of your medications and making sure that all your chronic conditions are well managed, is to keep moving. And the concern about falling is that once someone falls, they develop anxiety about falling and paradoxically begin to restrict their movement, which leads to deconditioning and more falling. So the key effectively is to stay in motion. Things in motion tend to stay in motion, and things that don't move tend to stop, hopefully not permanently. If there are specific concerns about gait or mobility or pain, often a primary care physician in collaboration with a physical therapist is the best person to see. But movement is medicine. I can't say it enough. Movement is medicine. These days, instead of handing a prescription for that drug that was advertised last night, I write down walk a mile a day and hand the prescription to folks so they don't feel like they've left the doctor's office without a prescription.
And so I'm a rheumatologist, actually, and I'll just mention also I have many patients who do have difficulty with mobility, and having the confidence that you can use assistive devices, right, so that you are able to be mobile and recognize that they help with balance or strength. But I think that the message is loud and clear, and that is staying mobile as long as possible and as much as possible is a great preventative therapy.
I also would like to add there are a few simple to-dos, which is be sure that your vision prescription is updated very frequently, because a lot about falling has to do with visual and depth perception. Be sure your vestibular system, meaning your hearing, your auditory, that part of your brain, which is telling your brain what position your body is in, is well, and that can be objectivized. And then work on balance. Balance is a very important thing I tell all of my patients starting in their mid-50s. Sorry, Mark. But I'm way older anyway. So to start working on balance as part of their regular exercise regime. And see, for instance, when you stand up, if you can stand on one foot for 30 seconds, you know, and if you can do that, I mean, that shows some reasonable degree of balance. But, doing it with your eyes closed may be too much. But start by testing your balance.
And don't text while you walk.
that's key.
Other questions? Yes, Barbara. So the question was a little bit more about sleep. Yeah, sleep and snoring, and there's an entire field, of course, of sleep medicine and sleep disorders. But I think we're talking about a lot of different things with sleep. So
sleep changes as you age, and we tend to need less sleep as we get older. Patients often say, how much should I be sleeping? And it's very variable. The person who slept 9 hours as a 20 or 30-year-old may only need 6.5 hours. But in general, I kind of like the number of about 6 hours of sleep. Part of it also really depends on the quality of sleep. If you're waking up many times a night, then you're interfering with REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, which is the most restorative phase of sleep. So it may be a medication, it may be something, some other habit that's interfering with the good part of your sleep, and that's as important as how much you sleep. Alcohol, which we generally drink at night, not in the morning, is a major impediment to effective REM sleep. And that's usually my first piece of advice. If people are having trouble sleeping, try to remove the alcohol and you'll see a very big difference right away.
So the question is there a place for sleep aids? You know, especially in individuals who are sleeping for just short periods during the night, 3 hours a night. Would you think about sleep aids for these individuals?
If you feel rested and you're functioning well in your daily life and 3 hours is what you sleep, then I don't see it as a problem necessarily. There's a lot of extra time there. I'm not sure what you're going to do, but you may be extremely productive. But apart from that, there's always, I don't love sleep aids. Most of them have way more side effects. They leave you drowsy during the day. They impair cognitive function. There was a new study that suggested maybe even permanently so. I don't love sleep aids. I would say for the person who's really struggling with the duration of their sleep, it's best to get a sleep study. At Weill Cornell, we have a wonderful state-of-the-art sleep center that is co-directed by pulmonary medicine and neurology departments, and they evaluate your sleep, they assess your sleep for quality, and they can make concrete suggestions on the improvement of sleep that may have to do with the architecture of your mouth, as per the snoring and other problems, or other kinds of things that are affecting your sleep.
Other questions? Maybe I'll ask one more to you, Mark. So what you spoke about a lot was ways to prevent frailty, I guess, and aging with difficulty. What happens if you're already down that road? Are some of the things that you talked about ways that one could intervene and then move to a not chronological but biologically earlier age?
Yeah. Well, I work with a nurse scientist at Cornell named Janie Peterson, who's now looking at exercise in the frailest frail. And I find this data very compelling. Janie has taken patients with really rather extraordinarily advanced chronic illness, multiple illnesses. They say, talk to your doctor before beginning an exercise program. These are patients who most doctors would say, forget about it. And Janie's been exercising them. And it's quite compelling that even small amounts of exercise, I mean walking down your New York City corridor to the elevator and back several times, small kilocalorie expenditures has produced better sleep, some suggestion of increased longevity in people with limited life expectancy. So I don't think you have to swing for the fences. I don't think you need to drop, three dress sizes. I don't think you need to be running marathons. I think modest amounts of everything we've talked about, exercise, socialization, really can work for people, even in the setting of frailty and chronic illness, Gary.
Great, thanks. Oh, yes, one more question. Yeah. So the question involved the technologies. So you talked a lot about cell phones, smartphones. How do they interface with FDA-approved medical appliances?
So I don't think right now they interface that seamlessly, but one of the areas that often people get medical device when something is seriously wrong, and I think the potential of using devices that we carry is it could somewhat be preventative, but ultimately they should talk to each other. And one other comment I wanted to make about the sleep, also one of the things that we've done that the advantage of technology is that before even you go to a sleep lab, you can do a lot of things at home. And also, for example, one of the things we looked at is just how is your body clock and sleep connected. And one of our recent studies showed that just not sleeping the time your body wants you to sleep, there was about a 30% drop in your responsiveness. So with a standard kind of responsiveness test. So I think one of the things where also technology can help is kind of finding you aligned not only how much you should sleep, but when you should sleep for your best alertness level.
So medical devices are relevant, are coming onto the market. They obviously do so more slowly than just a new app does. And but some of these applications that are software based, once they've been proven, will ultimately need to become medical devices as well. But that's a smaller subset. Basically, something's considered a medical device when the data from it are actually used in clinical decision making. And so it's a gray line, but the FDA is getting better at figuring out what that gray line is so that they take care when they need to and they don't stifle the innovation when they don't.
Great. Well, I think our time is up. I want to thank the panelists again. Thank you very much. But even more importantly, I'd like to thank the audience. The questions were great, and we feel privileged to have been asked to participate today. So have a great rest of the celebration.